in his bedroom on Privet Drive. Hermione gasped and started making suggestions at once, mentioning a number of reference books, and everybody from Albus Dumbledore to Madame Pomfrey, the Hogwarts nurse. Ron simply looked dumbstruck.
"But he wasn't there, was he? You know who? I mean, last time your scar kept hurting, he was at Hogwarts, wasn't he?"
"I'm sure he wasn't on Privet Drive," said Harry, "but I was dreaming about him, him and Peter, you know, Wormtail. I can't remember all of it now, but they were plotting to kill someone." He had teetered for a moment on the verge of saying, "me," but couldn't bring himself to make Hermione look any more horrified than she already did.
"It was only a dream," said Ron bracingly, "just a nightmare."
"Yeah, but was it, though?" said Harry, turning to look out of the window at the brightening sky. "It's weird, isn't it? My scar hurts, and 3 days later the Death Eaters are on the march, and Voldemort's sign's up in the sky again."
"Don't say his name,"
Ron hissed through gritted teeth.
"And remember what Professor Trelawney said," Harry went on, ignoring Ron,
"at the end of last year?" Professor Trelawney was their divination teacher at Hogwarts. Hermione's terrified look vanished as she let out a derisive snort.
"Oh, Harry, you aren't going to pay any attention to anything that old fraud says."
"You weren't there," said Harry. "You didn't hear her.
This time was different. I told you, she went into a trance, a real one, and she said the Dark Lord would rise again, greater and more terrible than ever before, and he'd manage it because his servant was going to go back to him. And that night, Wormtail escaped."
There was a silence in which Ron fidgeted absent-mindedly with a hole in his Chudley Cannon's bedspread.
"Why were you asking if Hedwig had come, Harry?"
Hermione asked.
"Are you expecting a letter?"
"I told Sirius about my scar," said Harry, shrugging. "I'm waiting for his answer."
"Good thinking!" said Ron, his expression clearing. "I bet Sirius'll know what to do."
"I hoped he'd get back to me quickly," said Harry.
"But we don't know where Sirius is. He could be in Africa or somewhere, couldn't he?"
said Hermione reasonably.
"Hedwig's not going to manage that journey in a few days."
"Yeah, I know," said Harry, but there was a leaden feeling in his stomach as he looked out of the window at the Hedwig-free sky.
"Come and have a game of Quidditch in the orchard, Harry," said Ron. "Come on, 3-on-3. Bill and Charlie and Fred and George will play. You can try out the Ronsky feint."
"Ron," said Hermione, in an I-don't-think-you're-being-very-sensitive sort of voice.
"Harry doesn't want to play Quidditch right now. He's worried, and he's tired. We all need to go to bed."
"Yeah, I want to play Quidditch," said Harry suddenly. "Hang on, I'll get my firebolt." Hermione left the room, muttering something that sounded very much like,
"Boys."
Neither Mr. Weasley nor Percy was at home much over the following week. Both left the house each morning before the rest of the family got up, and returned well after dinner every night.
"It's been an absolute uproar,"
Percy told them importantly the Sunday evening before they were due to return to Hogwarts. "I've been putting out fires all week. People keep sending howlers, and of course if you don't open a howler straight away, it explodes. Scorch marks all over my desk, and my best quill reduced to cinders."
"Why are they all sending howlers?"
asked Ginny, who was mending her copy of 1,000 Magical Herbs and Fungi with spellotape on the rug in front of the living room fire.
"Complaining about security at the World Cup," said Percy. "They want compensation for their ruined property. Mundungus Fletcher's put in a claim for a 12-bedroom tent with ensuite jacuzzi. But I've got his number. I know for a fact he was sleeping under a cloak propped on sticks."
Mrs. Weasley glanced at the grandfather clock in the corner. Harry liked this clock. It was completely useless if you wanted to know the time, but otherwise very informative. It had 9 golden hands, and each of them was engraved with one of the Weasley family's names. There were no numerals around the face, but descriptions of where each family member might be. Home, school, and work were there, but there was also travelling, lost, hospital, prison, and, in the position where the number 12 would be on a normal clock, mortal peril. 8 of the hands were currently pointing to the home position, but Mr. Weasley's, which was the longest, was still pointing to work. Mrs. Weasley sighed. "Your father hasn't had to go into the office on weekends since the days of you-know-who," she said. "They're working him far too hard. His dinner's going to be ruined if he doesn't come home soon."
"Well, Father feels he's got to make up for his mistake at the match, doesn't he?" said Percy. "If truth be told, he was a tad unwise to make a public statement without clearing it with his head of department first."
"Don't you dare blame your father for what that wretched Skeeter woman wrote," said Mrs. Weasley, flaring up at once. "If Dad hadn't said anything, old Rita would have just said it was disgraceful that nobody from the ministry had commented," said Bill, who was playing chess with Ron. "Rita Skeeter never makes anyone look good. Remember, she interviewed all the Gringotts charm breakers once and called me a long-haired pillock."
"Well, it is a bit long, dear," said Mrs. Weasley gently. "If you'd just let me—"
"No, Mum."
Rain lashed against the living room window. Hermione was immersed in the Standard Book of Spells, Grade 4, copies of which Mrs. Weasley had bought for her, Harry, and Ron in Diagon Alley. Charlie was darning a fireproof balaclava. Harry was polishing his firebolt, the broomstick servicing kit Hermione had given him for his 13th birthday, open at his feet. Fred and George were sitting in a far corner, quills out, talking in whispers, their heads bent over a piece of parchment.
"What are you two up to?"
said Mrs. Weasley sharply, her eyes on the twins.
"Homework,"
said Fred vaguely.
"Don't be ridiculous, you're still on holiday,"
said Mrs. Weasley.
"Yeah, we've left it a bit late," said George. "You're not by any chance writing out a new order form, are you?"
said Mrs. Weasley shrewdly.
"You wouldn't be thinking of restarting Weasley's Wizard Wheezes, by any chance?"
"Now, Mum," said Fred, looking up at her, a pained look on his face, "if the Hogwarts Express crashed tomorrow and George and I died, how would you feel to know that the last thing we ever heard from you was an unfounded accusation?" Everyone laughed, even Mrs. Weasley.
"Oh, your father's coming,"
she said suddenly, looking up at the clock again. Mr. Weasley's hand had suddenly spun from work to travelling. A second later, it had shuddered to a halt on home with the others, and they heard him calling from the kitchen.
"Coming, Arthur!"
called Mrs. Weasley, hurrying out of the room. A few moments later, Mr. Weasley came into the warm living room, carrying his dinner on a tray. He looked completely exhausted.
"Well, the fat's really in the fire now,"
he told Mrs. Weasley, as he sat down in an armchair near the hearth and toyed unenthusiastically with his somewhat shriveled cauliflower.
"Rita Skeet has been ferreting around all week, looking for more ministry mess-ups to report. And now she's found out about poor old Bertha going missing. So that'll be the headline in the Prophet tomorrow. I told Bagman he should have sent someone to look for her ages ago."
"Mr. Crouch has been saying it for weeks and weeks," said Percy swiftly.
"Crouch is very lucky Rita hasn't found out about Winky," said Mr. Weasley irritably. "There'd be a week's worth of headlines in his house elf being caught, holding the wand that conjured the dark mark."
"I thought we were all agreed that that elf, while irresponsible, did not conjure the mark," said Percy hotly.
"If you ask me, Mr. Crouch is very lucky no one at the Daily Prophet knows how mean he is to elves," said Hermione angrily.
"Now look here, Hermione," said Percy. "A high-ranking ministry official like Mr. Crouch deserves unswerving obedience from his servants."
"His slave, you mean," said Hermione, her voice rising passionately.
"Because he didn't pay Winky, did he?"
"I think you'd all better go upstairs and check that you've packed properly," said Mrs. Weasley, breaking up the argument.
"Come on now, all of you!"
Harry repacked his broomstick servicing kit, put his firebolt over his shoulder, and went back upstairs with Ron. The rain sounded even louder at the top of the house, accompanied by loud whistlings and moans from the wind, not to mention sporadic howls from the ghoul who lived in the attic. Pigwidgeon began twittering and zooming around his cage when they entered. The sight of the half-packed trunks seemed to have sent him into a frenzy of excitement.
"Bung him some owl treats," said Ron, throwing a packet across to Harry. "It might shut him up."
Harry poked a few owl treats through the bars of Pigwidgeon's cage, then turned to his trunk. Hedwig's cage stood next to it, still empty.
"It's been over a week.
Harry said, looking at Hedwig's deserted perch.
"Ron, you don't reckon Sirius has been caught, do you?"
"Nah, it would have been in the Daily Prophet," said Ron. "The Ministry would want to show they'd caught someone, wouldn't they?"
"Yeah, I suppose.
Look, here's the stuff Mum got for you in Diagon Alley, and she's got some gold out of your vault for you, and she's washed all your socks."
He heaved a pile of parcels onto Harry's camp bed and dropped the money bag and a load of socks next to it. Harry started unwrapping the shopping. Apart from the Standard Book of Spells, Grade 4, by Miranda Goshawk, he had a handful of new quills, a dozen rolls of parchment, and refills for his potion-making kit. He had been running low on Spine of Lionfish, an essence of Belladonna. He was just piling underwear into his cauldron when Ron made a loud noise of disgust behind him.
"What is that supposed to be?"
He was holding up something that looked to Harry like a long maroon velvet dress. It had a mouldy-looking lace frill at the collar and matching lace cuffs. There was a knock on the door, and Mrs. Weasley entered, carrying an armful of freshly laundered Hogwarts robes.
"Here you are," she said, sorting them into two piles. "Now mind you pack them properly so they don't crease."
"Mom, you've given me Ginny's new dress," said Ron, handing it out to her.
"Of course I haven't," said Mrs. Weasley. "That's for you. Dress robes."
"What?"
said Ron, looking horror-struck.
"Dress robes," repeated Mrs. Weasley. "It says on your school list that you're supposed to have dress robes this year, robes for formal occasions."
"You've got to be kidding," said Ron in disbelief. "I'm not wearing that."
"No way."
"Everyone wears them, Ron," said Mrs. Weasley crossly. "They're all like that. Your father's got some for smart parties."
"I'll go Starkers before I put that on," said Ron stubbornly.
"Don't be so silly," said Mrs. Weasley. "You've got to have dress robes. They're on your list.
I got some for Harry, too. Show him, Harry."
In some trepidation, Harry opened the last parcel on his camp bed. It wasn't as bad as he had expected, however. His dress robes didn't have any lace on them at all. In fact, they were more or less the same as his school ones, except that they were bottle green instead of black.
"I thought they'd bring out the colour of your eyes, dear," said Mrs. Weasley fondly.
"Well, they're okay,"
said Ron angrily, looking at Harry's robes.
"Why couldn't I have some like that?"
"Because, well, I had to get yours second-hand, and there wasn't a lot of choice," said Mrs. Weasley, flushing.
Harry looked away. He would willingly have split all the money in his Gringotts vault with the Weasleys, but he knew they would never take it.
"I'm never wearing them," Ron was saying stubbornly. "Never."
"Fine," snapped Mrs. Weasley. "Go naked! And, Harry, make sure you get a picture of him. Goodness knows I could do with a laugh."
She left the room, slamming the door behind her. There was a funny, spluttering noise from behind them. Pigwidgeon was choking on an overlarge owl treat.
"Why is everything I own rubbish?"
said Ron furiously, striding across the room to unstick Pigwidgeon's beak. Chapter 11 Aboard the Hogwarts Express. There was a definite end of the holidays gloom in the air when Harry awoke next morning. Heavy rain was still splattering against the window as he got dressed in jeans and a sweatshirt. They would change into their school robes on the Hogwarts Express. He, Ron, Fred, and George had just reached the first floor landing on their way down to breakfast when Mrs. Weasley appeared at the foot of the stairs looking harassed.
"Arthur!"
she called up the staircase.
"Arthur! Urgent message from the Ministry!"
Harry flattened himself against the wall as Mr. Weasley came clattering past with his robes on back to front and hurtled out of sight. When Harry and the others entered the kitchen, they saw Mrs. Weasley rummaging anxiously in the drawers.
"I've got a quill here somewhere."
And Mr. Weasley bending over the fire, talking to... Harry shut his eyes hard and opened them again to make sure that they were working properly. Amos Diggory's head was sitting in the middle of the flames like a large bearded egg. It was talking very fast, completely unperturbed by the sparks flying around it and the flames licking its ears.
"Muggle neighbours heard bangs and shouting, so they went and called those... what do you call 'ems? Pleasemen. Arthur, you've got to get over there."
"Here," said Mrs. Weasley breathlessly, pushing a piece of parchment, a bottle of ink, and a crumpled quill into Mr. Weasley's hands.
"It's a real stroke of luck I heard about it," said Mr. Diggory's head. "I had to come into the office early to send a couple of owls, and I found the improper use of magic lot all setting off. If Rita Skeeter gets hold of this one, Arthur..."
"What does Mad-Eye say happened?" asked Mr. Weasley, unscrewing the ink bottle, loading up his quill, and preparing to take notes. Mr. Diggory's head rolled its eyes.
"Says he heard an intruder in his yard. Says he was creeping toward the house, but was ambushed by his dustbins."
"What did the dustbins do?" asked Mr. Weasley, scribbling frantically.
"Made one hell of a noise and fired rubbish everywhere, as far as I can tell," said Mr. Diggory. "Apparently, one of them was still rocketing around when the police men turned up."
Mr. Weasley groaned.
"And what about the intruder?" "Arthur, you know Mad-Eye," said Mr. Diggory's head, rolling its eyes again. "Someone creeping into his yard in the dead of night. More likely there's a very shell-shocked cat wandering around somewhere, covered in potato peelings. But if the improper use of magic lock get their hands on Mad-Eye, he's had it. Think of his record. We've got to get him off on a minor charge. Something in your department. What are exploding dustbins worth?"
"Might be a caution," said Mr. Weasley, still writing very fast, his brow furrowed.
"Mad-Eye didn't use his wand? He didn't actually attack anyone?" "I'll bet he leapt out of bed and started jinxing everything he could reach through the window," said Mr. Diggory. "But they'll have a job proving it. There aren't any casualties."
"All right, I'm off," Mr. Weasley said, and he stuffed the parchment with his notes on it into his pocket and dashed out of the kitchen again. Mr. Diggory's head looked around at Mrs. Weasley.
"Sorry about this, Molly," it said more calmly. "Bothering you so early and everything. But Arthur's the only one who can get Mad-Eye off, and Mad-Eye's supposed to be starting his new job today. Why, he had to choose last night."
"Never mind, Amos," said Mrs. Weasley. "Sure you won't have a bit of toast or anything before you go?"
"Oh, go on then," said Mr. Diggory.
Mrs. Weasley took a piece of buttered toast from a stack on the kitchen table, put it into the fire tongs, and transferred it into Mr. Diggory's mouth.
"Thanks,"
he said in a muffled voice, and then, with a small pop, vanished. Harry could hear Mr. Weasley call in hurried goodbyes to Bill, Charlie, Percy, and the girls. Within 5 minutes he was back in the kitchen, his robes on the right way now, dragging a comb through his hair.
"I'd better hurry. You have a good term, boys,"
said Mr. Weasley to Harry, Ron, and the twins, fastening a cloak over his shoulders and preparing to disapparate.
"Molly, are you going to be all right taking the kids to King's Cross?"
"Of course I will," she said. "You just look after Mad-Eye. We'll be fine." As Mr. Weasley vanished, Bill and Charlie entered the kitchen.
"Did someone say Mad-Eye?"
Bill asked. "What's he been up to now?"
"He says someone tried to break into his house last night," said Mrs. Weasley.
"Mad-Eye Moody?" said George thoughtfully, spreading marmalade on his toast.
"Isn't he that nutter? Your father thinks very highly of Mad-Eye Moody," said Mrs. Weasley sternly.
"Yeah, well, Dad collects plugs, doesn't he?" said Fred quietly, as Mrs. Weasley left the room. "Birds of a feather."
"Moody was a great wizard in his time," said Bill.
"He's an old friend of Dumbledore's, isn't he?" said Charlie.
"Dumbledore's not what you'd call normal, though, is he?" said Fred. "I mean, I know he's a genius and everything."
"Who is Mad-Eye?" asked Harry.
"He's retired. Used to work at the Ministry," said Charlie. "I met him once when Dad took me in to work with him. He was an aura. One of the best.
A dark wizard catcher," he added, seeing Harry's blank look. "Half the cells in Azkaban are full because of him.
He made himself loads of enemies, though. The families of people he caught, mainly. And I heard he's been getting really paranoid in his old age. Doesn't trust anyone anymore. Sees dark wizards everywhere."
Bill and Charlie decided to come and see everyone off at King's Cross Station, but Percy, apologizing most profusely, said that he really needed to get to work.
"I just can't justify taking more time off at the moment," he told them. "Mr. Crouch is really starting to rely on me."
"Yeah. You know what, Percy?" said George seriously. "I reckon he'll know your name soon."
Mrs. Weasley had braved the telephone in the village post office to order 3 ordinary Muggle taxis to take them into London.
"Arthur tried to borrow ministry cars for us," Mrs. Weasley whispered to Harry, as they stood in the rain-washed yard, watching the taxi drivers heaving 6 heavy hog-walked trunks into their cars. "But there weren't any to spare. Oh, dear, they don't look happy, do they?"
Harry didn't like to tell Mrs. Weasley that Muggle taxi drivers rarely transported over-excited owls, and Pigwidgeon was making an ear-splitting racket. Nor did it help that a number of Filibuster's fabulous no-heat, wet-start fireworks went off unexpectedly when Fred's trunk sprang open, causing the driver carrying it to yell with fright and pain as Crookshanks clawed his way up the man's leg. The journey was uncomfortable, owing to the fact that they were jammed in the back of the taxis with their trunks. Crookshanks took quite a while to recover from the fireworks, and by the time they entered London, Harry, Ron, and Hermione were all severely scratched. They were very relieved to get out at King's Cross, even though the rain was coming down harder than ever, and they got soaked carrying their trunks across the busy road and into the station. Harry was used to getting onto platform 9 3/4 by now. It was a simple matter of walking straight through the apparently solid barrier dividing platforms 9 and 10. The only tricky part was doing this in an unobtrusive way so as to avoid attracting Muggle attention. They did it in groups today. Harry, Ron, and Hermione, the most conspicuous, since they were accompanied by Pigwidgeon and Crookshanks, went first. They leaned casually against the barrier, chatting unconcernedly, and slid sideways through it. And as they did so, platform 9 3/4 materialized in front of them. The Hogwarts Express, a gleaming scarlet steam engine, was already there, clouds of steam billowing from it, through which the many Hogwarts students and parents on the platform appeared like dark ghosts. Pigwidgeon became noisier than ever in response to the hooting of many owls through the mist. Harry, Ron, and Hermione set off to find seats, and were soon stowing their luggage in a compartment halfway along the train. They then hopped back down onto the platform to say goodbye to Mrs. Weasley, Bill, and Charlie.
"I might be seeing you all sooner than you think," said Charlie, grinning, as he hugged Ginny goodbye.
"Why?" said Fred keenly.
"You'll see," said Charlie. "Just don't tell Percy I mentioned it. It's classified information until such time as the Ministry sees fit to release it, after all."
"Yeah, I sort of wish I were back at Hogwarts this year," said Bill, hands in his pockets, looking almost wistfully at the train.
"Why?" said George impatiently.
"You're going to have an interesting year," said Bill, his eyes twinkling. "I might even get time off to come and watch a bit of it."
"A bit of what?"
said Ron. But at that moment the whistle blew, and Mrs. Weasley chivied them toward the train doors.
"Thanks for having us to stay, Mrs. Weasley," said Hermione, as they climbed on board, closed the door, and leaned out of the window to talk to her.
"Yeah, thanks for everything, Mrs. Weasley," said Harry.
"Oh, it was my pleasure, dears," said Mrs. Weasley. "I'd invite you for Christmas, but, well, I expect you're all going to want to stay at Hogwarts, what with one thing and another."
"Mum," said Ron irritably, "what do you three know that we don't?"
"You'll find out this evening, I expect," said Mrs. Weasley, smiling.
"It's going to be very exciting, mind you. I'm very glad they've changed the rules."
"What rules?" said Harry, Ron, Fred, and George together.
"I'm sure Professor Dumbledore will tell you. Now, behave, won't you? Won't you, Fred? And you, George?"
The pistons hissed loudly, and the train began to move.
"Tell us what's happening at Hogwarts,"
Fred bellowed out of the window as Mrs. Weasley, Bill, and Charlie sped away from them.
"What rules are they changing?"
But Mrs. Weasley only smiled and waved. Before the train had rounded the corner, she, Bill, and Charlie had disapparated. Harry, Ron, and Hermione went back to their compartment. The thick rain splattering the windows made it very difficult to see out of them. Ron undid his trunk, pulled out his maroon dress robes, and flung them over Pigwidgeon's cage to muffle his hooting.
"Bagman wanted to tell us what's happening at Hogwarts," he said grumpily, sitting down next to Harry. "At the World Cup, remember? But my own mother won't say. Wonder what—"
Hermione whispered suddenly, pressing her finger to her lips and pointing toward the compartment next to theirs. Harry and Ron listened, and heard a familiar drawling voice drifting in through the open door.
Father actually considered sending me to Durmstrang rather than Hogwarts, you know. He knows the headmaster, you see. Well, you know his opinion of Dumbledore. The man's such a mudblood lover, and Durmstrang doesn't admit that sort of riffraff. But Mother didn't like the idea of me going to school so far away. Father says Durmstrang takes a far more sensible line than Hogwarts about the dark arts. Durmstrang students actually learn them, not just the defense rubbish we do. Hermione got up, tiptoed to the compartment door, and slid it shut, blocking out Malfoy's voice.
"So he thinks Durmstrang would have suited him, does he?" she said angrily. "I wish he had gone, then we wouldn't have to put up with him."
"Durmstrang's another wizarding school?" said Harry.
"Yes," said Hermione sniffily, "and it's got a horrible reputation. According to an appraisal of magical education in Europe, it puts a lot of emphasis on the dark arts."
"I think I've heard of it," said Ron vaguely. "Where is it? What country?"
"Well, nobody knows, do they?"
said Hermione, raising her eyebrows.
Why not?" said Harry. "There's traditionally been a lot of rivalry between all the magic schools. Durmstrang and Beauxbatons like to conceal their whereabouts, so nobody can steal their secrets," said Hermione matter-of-factly.
"Come off it," said Ron, starting to laugh. "Durmstrang's got to be about the same size as Hogwarts. How are you going to hide a great big castle?"
"But Hogwarts is hidden," said Hermione in surprise. "Everyone knows that. Well, everyone who's read Hogwarts, a history, anyway."
"Just you, then," said Ron.
"So go on, how do you hide a place like Hogwarts?" "It's bewitched," said Hermione. "If a muggle looks at it, all they see is a mouldering old ruin, with a sign over the entrance saying, 'Danger, do not enter, unsafe.'"
"So Durmstrang will look just like a ruin to an outsider, too."
"Maybe," said Hermione, shrugging. "Or it might have muggle-repelling charms on it, like the World Cup stadium. And to keep foreign wizards from finding it, they'll have made it unplottable."
"Come again?"
"Well, you can enchant a building so it's impossible to plot on a map, can't you?"
If you say so," said Harry.
"But I think Durmstrang must be somewhere in the far north," said Hermione thoughtfully. "Somewhere very cold, because they've got fur capes as part of their uniforms."
"Ah, think of the possibilities," said Ron dreamily. "It would have been so easy to push Malfoy off a glacier and make it look like an accident. Shame his mother likes him."
The rain became heavier and heavier as the train moved farther north. The sky was so dark and the windows so steamy that the lanterns were lit by midday. The lunch trolley came rattling along the corridor, and Harry bought a large stack of cauldron cakes for them to share. Several of their friends looked in on them as the afternoon progressed, including Seamus Finnegan, Dean Thomas, and Neville Longbottom, a round-faced, extremely forgetful boy who had been brought up by his formidable witch of a grandmother. Seamus was still wearing his Ireland rosette. Some of its magic seemed to be wearing off now. It was still squeaking,
"Troy, Mullet, Moran,"
but in a very feeble and exhausted sort of way. After half an hour or so, Hermione, growing tired of the endless Quidditch talk, buried herself once more in the Standard Book of Spells, Grade 4, and started trying to learn a summoning charm. Neville listened jealously to the others' conversation as they relived the cup match.
"Gran didn't want to go," he said miserably. "Wouldn't buy tickets. It sounded amazing, though."
"It was," said Ron. "Look at this, Neville."
He rummaged in his trunk up in the luggage rack and pulled out the miniature figure of Victor Crumb.
"Oh, wow,"
said Neville enviously as Ron tipped Crumb onto his pudgy hand.
"We saw him right up close as well," said Ron. "We were in the top box."
"For the first and last time in your life, Weasley."
Draco Malfoy had appeared in the doorway. Behind him stood Crabbe and Goyle, his enormous, thuggish cronies, both of whom appeared to have grown at least a foot during the summer. Evidently, they had overheard the conversation through the compartment door, which Dean and Seamus had left ajar.
"Don't remember asking you to join us, Malfoy," said Harry coolly.
"Weasley, what is that?" said Malfoy, pointing at Pigwidgeon's cage.
A sleeve of Ron's dress robes was dangling from it, swaying with the motion of the train, the mouldy lace cuff very obvious. Ron made to stuff the robes out of sight, but Malfoy was too quick for him. He seized the sleeve and pulled.
"Look at this!" said Malfoy, in ecstasy, holding up Ron's robes and showing Crabbe and Goyle. "Weasley, you weren't thinking of wearing these, were you? I mean, they were very fashionable in about 1890.
"Eat young, Malfoy," said Ron, the same colour as the dress robes, as he snatched them back out of Malfoy's grip. Malfoy howled with derisive laughter. Crabbe and Goyle guffawed stupidly.
"So, going to enter, Weasley? Going to try and bring a bit of glory to the family name? There's money involved as well, you know. You'd be able to afford some decent robes if you won."
"What are you talking about?" snapped Ron.
"Are you going to enter?" Malfoy repeated. "I suppose you will, Potter. You never miss a chance to show off, do you?"
"Either explain what you're on about, or go away, Malfoy," said Hermione testily over the top of the Standard Book of Spells, Grade 4. A gleeful smile spread across Malfoy's pale face.
"Don't tell me you don't know," he said delightedly. "You've got a father and brother at the Ministry, and you don't even know. My God, my father told me about it ages ago. Heard it from Cornelius Fudge. But then, father's always associated with the top people at the Ministry. Maybe your father's too junior to know about it, Weasley. Yes, they probably don't talk about important stuff in front of him."
Laughing once more, Malfoy beckoned to Crabbe and Goyle, and the three of them disappeared. Ron got to his feet and slammed the sliding compartment door so hard behind them that the glass shattered.
"Ron!" said Hermione reproachfully, and she pulled out her wand, muttered, "Reparo!"
and the glass shards flew back into a single pane and back into the door.
"Well, making it look like he knows everything and we don't," Ron snarled. "Father's always associated with the top people at the Ministry. Dad could have got a promotion any time. He just likes it where he is."
"Of course he does," said Hermione quietly. "Don't let Malfoy get to you, Ron."
"Him? Get to me? As if," said Ron, picking up one of the remaining cauldron cakes and squashing it into a pulp. Ron's bad mood continued for the rest of the journey. He didn't talk much as they changed into their school robes, and was still glowering when the Hogwarts Express slowed down at last and finally stopped in the pitch darkness of Hogsmeade Station. As the train doors opened, there was a rumble of thunder overhead. Hermione bundled up Crookshanks in her cloak, and Ron left his dress robes over Pigwidgeon as they left the train, heads bent and eyes narrowed against the downpour. The rain was now coming down so thick and fast that it was as though buckets of ice-cold water were being emptied repeatedly over their heads.
"Hi, Hagrid!"
Harry yelled, seeing a gigantic silhouette at the far end of the platform.
"All right, Harry!"
Hagrid bellowed back, waving.
"See you at the feast if we don't drown!"
First years traditionally reached Hogwarts Castle by sailing across the lake with Hagrid.
"Ooh, I wouldn't fancy crossing the lake in this weather," said Hermione fervently, shivering as they inched slowly along the dark platform with the rest of the crowd.
100 horseless carriages stood waiting for them outside the station. Harry, Ron, Hermione, and Neville climbed gratefully into one of them. The door shut with a snap, and a few moments later, with a great lurch, the long procession of carriages was rumbling and splashing its way up the track toward Hogwarts Castle. Chapter 12. The Tri-Wizard Tournament. Through the gates, flanked with statues of winged boars, and up the sweeping drive the carriages trundled, swaying dangerously in what was fast becoming a gale. Leaning against the window, Harry could see Hogwarts coming nearer, its many lighted windows blurred and shimmering behind the thick curtain of rain. Lightning flashed across the sky as their carriage came to a halt before the great oak front doors, which stood at the top of a flight of stone steps. People who had occupied the carriages in front were already hurrying up the stone steps into the castle. Harry, Ron, Hermione, and Neville jumped down from their carriage and dashed up the steps too, looking up only when they were safely inside the cavernous, torch-lit entrance hall with its magnificent marble staircase.
"Blimey!" said Ron, shaking his head and sending water everywhere. "If that keeps up, the lake's going to overflow. I'm soaked. Ah!"
A large, red, water-filled balloon had dropped from out of the ceiling onto Ron's head and exploded. Drenched and sputtering, Ron staggered sideways into Harry, just as a second water bomb dropped. Narrowly missing Hermione, it burst at Harry's feet, sending a wave of cold water over his sneakers into his socks. People all around them shrieked and started pushing one another in their efforts to get out of the line of fire. Harry looked up and saw, floating 20 feet above them, Peeves, the poltergeist, a little man in a bell-covered hat and orange bow tie, his wide, malicious face contorted with concentration as he took aim again.
"Peeves!" yelled an angry voice. "Peeves, come down here at once!"
Professor McGonagall, deputy headmistress and head of Gryffindor House, had come dashing out of the great hall. She skidded on the wet floor and grabbed Hermione around the neck to stop herself from falling.
"Ouch! Sorry, Miss Granger!"
"That's all right, Professor," Hermione gasped, massaging her throat.
"Peeves, get down here now,"
barked Professor McGonagall, straightening her pointed hat and glaring upward through her square-rimmed spectacles.
"Not doing nothing,"
cackled Peeves, lobbing a water bomb at several fifth-year girls who screamed and dived into the great hall.
"Already wet, aren't they? Little squirts. Whee!"
And he aimed another bomb at a group of second years who had just arrived.
"I shall call the headmaster,"
shouted Professor McGonagall.
"I'm warning you, Peeves."
Peeves stuck out his tongue, threw the last of his water bombs into the air, and zoomed off up the marble staircase, cackling insanely.
"Well, move along then,"
said Professor McGonagall sharply to the bedraggled crowd.
"Into the great hall. Come on."
Harry, Ron, and Hermione slipped and slid across the entrance hall and through the double doors on the right, Ron muttering furiously under his breath as he pushed his sopping hair off his face. The great hall looked its usual splendid self, decorated for the start of term feast. Golden plates and goblets gleamed by the light of hundreds and hundreds of candles floating over the tables in mid-air. The four long house tables were packed with chattering students. At the top of the hall, the staff sat along one side of a fifth table, facing their pupils. It was much warmer in here. Harry, Ron, and Hermione walked past the Slytherins, the Ravenclaws, and the Hufflepuffs, and sat down with the rest of the Gryffindors at the far side of the hall, next to nearly headless Nick, the Gryffindor ghost. Pearly white and semi-transparent, Nick was dressed tonight in his usual doublet, but with a particularly large ruff, which served the dual purpose of looking extra festive and ensuring that his head didn't wobble too much on his partially severed neck.
"Good evening," he said, beaming at them.
"Says who?" said Harry, taking off his sneakers and emptying them of water.
"Hope they hurry up with the sorting. I'm starving." The sorting of the new students into houses took place at the start of every school year, but by an unlucky combination of circumstances, Harry hadn't been present at one since his own. He was quite looking forward to it. Just then, a highly excited, breathless voice called down the table.
"Hiya, Harry!"
It was Colin Creevy, a third year to whom Harry was something of a hero.
"Hi, Colin," said Harry warily.
"Harry, guess what? Guess what, Harry? My brother's starting. My brother Dennis."
Good, said Harry.
"He's really excited,"
said Colin, practically bouncing up and down in his seat.
"I just hope he's in Gryffindor. Keep your fingers crossed, hey, Harry?"
Yeah, all right, said Harry.
He turned back to Hermione, Ron, and nearly headless Nick. "Brothers and sisters usually go in the same houses, don't they?" he said. He was judging by the Weasleys, all seven of whom had been put into Gryffindor.
"Oh, no, not necessarily," said Hermione. "Parvati Patil's twins in Ravenclaw, and they're identical. You'd think they'd be together, wouldn't you?"
Harry looked up at the staff table. There seemed to be rather more empty seats there than usual. Hagrid, of course, was still fighting his way across the lake with the first years.
Professor McGonagall was, presumably, supervising the drying of the entrance hall floor. But there was another empty chair, too, and Harry couldn't think who else was missing.
"Where's the new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher?"
said Hermione, who was also looking up at the teachers. They had never yet had a Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher who had lasted more than 3 terms. Harry's favourite by far had been Professor Lupin, who had resigned last year. He looked up and down the staff table. There was definitely no new face there.
"Maybe they couldn't get anyone," said Hermione, looking anxious.
Harry scanned the table more carefully. Tiny little Professor Flitwick, the charms teacher, was sitting on a large pile of cushions beside Professor Sprout, the herbology teacher, whose hat was askew over her flyaway grey hair. She was talking to Professor Sinistra of the astronomy department. On Professor Sinistra's other side was the sallow-faced, hook-nosed, greasy-haired potions master, Snape, Harry's least favourite person at Hogwarts. Harry's loathing of Snape was matched only by Snape's hatred of him, a hatred which had, if possible, intensified last year, when Harry had helped Sirius escape right under Snape's overlarge nose. Snape and Sirius had been enemies since their own school days. On Snape's other side was an empty seat, which Harry guessed was Professor McGonagall's. Next to it, and in the very centre of the table, sat Professor Dumbledore, the headmaster, his sweeping silver hair and beard shining in the candlelight, his magnificent deep green robes embroidered with many stars and moons. The tips of Dumbledore's long thin fingers were together, and he was resting his chin upon them, staring up at the ceiling through his half-moon spectacles as though lost in thought. Harry glanced up at the ceiling, too. It was enchanted to look like the sky outside, and he had never seen it look this stormy. Black and purple clouds were swirling across it, and, as another thunderclap sounded outside, a fork of lightning flashed across it.
"Oh, hurry up!" Ron moaned beside Harry. "Achilles, a hippogriff!"
The words were no sooner out of his mouth than the doors of the great hall opened and silence fell. Professor McGonagall was leading a long line of first years up to the top of the hall. If Harry, Ron, and Hermione were wet, it was nothing to how these first years looked. They appeared to have swum across the lake rather than sailed. All of them were shivering with a combination of cold and nerves as they filed along the staff table and came to a halt in a line facing the rest of the school. All of them, except the smallest of the lot, a boy with mousy hair, who was wrapped in what Harry recognized as Hagrid's moleskin overcoat. The coat was so big for him that it looked as though he were draped in a furry black circus tent. His small face protruded from over the collar, looking almost painfully excited. When he had lined up with his terrified-looking peers, he caught Colin Creevy's eye, gave a double thumbs up, and mouthed,
"I fell in the lake."
He looked positively delighted about it. Professor McGonagall now placed a 3-legged stool on the ground before the first years, and, on top of it, an extremely old, dirty, patched wizard's hat. The first years stared at it. So did everyone else. For a moment there was silence. Then a long tear near the brim opened wide like a mouth, and the hat broke into song.
"A 1,000 years or more ago, when I was newly sown, there lived 4 wizards of renown, whose names are still well known. Bold Gryffindor from Wildmoor, fair Ravenclaw from Glen, sweet Hufflepuff from Valley Broad, shrewd Slytherin from Fen. They shared a wish, a hope, a dream, they hatched a daring plan, to educate young sorcerers, thus Hogwarts School began. Now each of these 4 founders formed their own house for each, did value different virtues in the ones they had to teach. By Gryffindor the bravest were, prized far beyond the rest, for Ravenclaw the cleverest would always be the best. For Hufflepuff hard workers were, most worthy of admission, and power-hungry Slytherin loved those of great ambition. While still alive they did divide their favourites from the throng, yet how to pick the worthy ones when they were dead and gone? 'Twas Gryffindor who found the way, he whipped me off his head, The founders put some brains in me, so I could choose instead. Now slip me snug around your ears, I've never yet been wrong. I'll have a look inside your mind, and tell where you belong.
The great hall rang with applause as the sorting hat finished.
That's not the song it sang when it sorted us, said Harry, clapping along with everyone else.
Sings a different one every year, said Ron. It's got to be a pretty boring life, hasn't it, being a hat? I suppose it spends all year making up the next one.
Professor McGonagall was now unrolling a large scroll of parchment.
When I call out your name, you will put on the hat and sit on the stool, she told the first years. When the hat announces your house, you will go and sit at the appropriate table. Ackerley Stewart.
A boy walked forward, visibly trembling from head to foot, picked up the sorting hat, put it on, and sat down on the stool.
Ravenclaw, shouted the hat.
Stuart Ackerley took off the hat and hurried into a seat at the Ravenclaw table, where everyone was applauding him. Harry caught a glimpse of Cho, the Ravenclaw seeker, cheering Stuart Ackerley as he sat down. For a fleeting second, Harry had a strange desire to join the Ravenclaw table, too.
Baddock! Malcolm! Slytherin!
The table on the other side of the hall erupted with cheers. Harry could see Malfoy clapping as Baddock joined the Slytherins. Harry wondered whether Baddock knew that Slytherin House had turned out more dark witches and wizards than any other. Fred and George hissed Malcolm Baddock as he sat down.
Branston! Eleanor!
Hufflepuff!
Caldwell! Owen!
Hufflepuff!
Creevy! Dennis!
Tiny Dennis Creevy staggered forward, tripping over Hagrid's moleskin, just as Hagrid himself sidled into the hall through a door behind the teacher's table. About twice as tall as a normal man, and at least three times as broad, Hagrid, with his long, wild, tangled black hair and beard, looked slightly alarming, a misleading impression, for Harry, Ron, and Hermione knew Hagrid to possess a very kind nature. He winked at them as he sat down at the end of the staff table and watched Dennis Creevy putting on the sorting hat, the rip at the brim open wide.
"Gryffindor!"
the hat shouted. Hagrid clapped along with the Gryffindors as Dennis Creevy, beaming widely, took off the hat, placed it back on the stool, and hurried over to join his brother.
"Colin, I fell in!"
he said shrilly, throwing himself into an empty seat.
"It was brilliant, and something in the water grabbed me and pushed me back in the boat."
"Cool,"
said Colin just as excitedly.
"It was probably the giant squid, Dennis."
"Wow,"
said Dennis, as though nobody in their wildest dreams could hope for more than being thrown into a storm-tossed, fathoms-deep lake and pushed out of it again by a giant sea monster.
"Dennis, Dennis, see that boy down there? The one with the black hair and glasses? See him? Know who he is, Dennis?"
Harry looked away, staring very hard at the sorting hat, now sorting Emma Dobbs. The sorting continued, boys and girls with varying degrees of fright on their faces, moving one by one to the three-legged stool, the line dwindling slowly as Professor McGonagall passed the L's.
"Oh, hurry up,"
Ron moaned, massaging his stomach.
"Now, Ron, the sorting's much more important than food," said nearly headless Nick, as madly Laura became a Hufflepuff.
"Course it is, if you're dead," snapped Ron.
"I do hope this year's batch of Gryffindors are up to scratch," said nearly headless Nick, applauding as MacDonald Natalie joined the Gryffindor table. "We don't want to break our winning streak, do we?"
Gryffindor had won the Interhouse Championship for the last 3 years in a row.
"Pritchard Graham!
Slytherin!
Quirk!
Aula! Ravenclaw!"
And finally with
"Whitby Kevin!
Hufflepuff!"
the sorting ended. Professor McGonagall picked up the hat and the stool and carried them away.
"About time,"
said Ron, seizing his knife and fork and looking expectantly at his golden plate. Professor Dumbledore had gotten to his feet. He was smiling around at the students, his arms opened wide in welcome.
"I have only 2 words to say to you," he told them, his deep voice echoing around the hall.
"Tuck in."
"Hear, hear," said Harry and Ron loudly as the empty dishes filled magically before their eyes. Nearly headless Nick watched mournfully as Harry, Ron, and Hermione loaded their own plates.
"Ah, that's better,"
said Ron, with his mouth full of mashed potato.
"You're lucky there's a feast at all tonight, you know," said Nearly Headless Nick. "There was trouble in the kitchens earlier."
"Why? What happened?" said Harry, through a sizable chunk of steak.
"Peeves, of course," said Nearly Headless Nick, shaking his head, which wobbled dangerously.
He pulled his ruff a little higher up on his neck.
"The usual argument, you know. He wanted to attend the feast. Well, it's quite out of the question. You know what he's like. Utterly uncivilized. Can't see a plate of food without throwing it. We held a ghost's council. The fat friar was all for giving him the chance. But, most wisely in my opinion, the Bloody Baron put his foot down."
The Bloody Baron was the Slytherin ghost, a gaunt and silent spectre covered in silver bloodstains. He was the only person at Hogwarts who could really control Peeves.
"Yeah, we thought Peeves seemed hacked off about something," said Ron darkly. "So, what did he do in the kitchens?"
"Oh, the usual," said Nearly Headless Nick, shrugging. "Wreaked havoc and mayhem, pots and pans everywhere, place swimming in soup, terrified the house elves out of their wits."
Clang! Hermione had knocked over her golden goblet. Pumpkin juice spread steadily over the tablecloth, staining several feet of white linen orange. But Hermione paid no attention.
"There are house elves here?"
she said, staring, horror-struck, at Nearly Headless Nick.
"Here? At Hogwarts?"
"Certainly," said Nearly Headless Nick, looking surprised at her reaction. "The largest number in any dwelling in Britain, I believe. Over 100.
"I've never seen one," said Hermione.
"Well, they hardly ever leave the kitchen by day, do they?" said Nearly Headless Nick. "They come out at night to do a bit of cleaning, see to the fires and so on. I mean, you're not supposed to see them, are you? That's the mark of a good house elf, isn't it? That you don't know it's there."
Hermione stared at him.
"But they get paid," she said. "They get holidays, don't they? And sick leave, and pensions, and everything?"
Nearly Headless Nick chortled so much that his ruff slipped and his head flopped off, dangling on the inch or so of ghostly skin and muscle that still attached it to his neck.
"Sick leave and pensions?"
he said, pushing his head back onto his shoulders and securing it once more with his ruff.
"House elves don't want sick leave and pensions."
Hermione looked down at her hardly touched plate of food, then put her knife and fork down upon it and pushed it away from her.
"Oh, come on, Hermione," said Ron, accidentally spraying Harry with bits of Yorkshire pudding.
"Whoops, sorry, Harry." He swallowed.
"You won't get them sick leave by starving yourself." "Slave labour," said Hermione, breathing hard through her nose. "That's what made this dinner. Slave labour."
And she refused to eat another bite. The rain was still drumming heavily against the high, dark glass. Another clap of thunder shook the windows, and the stormy ceiling flashed, illuminating the golden plates as the remains of the first course vanished and were replaced instantly with puddings.
"Treacle tart, Hermione,"
said Ron, deliberately wafting its smell toward her.
"Spotted dick. Look, chocolate gâteau."
But Hermione gave him a look so reminiscent of Professor McGonagall that he gave up. When the puddings, too, had been demolished and the last crumbs had faded off the plates, leaving them sparkling clean, Albus Dumbledore got to his feet again. The buzz of chatter filling the hall ceased almost at once, so that only the howling wind and pounding rain could be heard.
"So," said Dumbledore, smiling around at all of them, "now that we are all fed and watered..."
"Hum," said Hermione.
"I must once more ask for your attention while I give out a few notices.
Mr. Filch, the caretaker, has asked me to tell you that the list of objects forbidden inside the castle has this year been extended to include screaming yo-yos, fanged frisbees, and ever-bashing boomerangs. The full list comprises some 437 items, I believe, and can be viewed in Mr. Filch's office if anybody would like to check it.
The corners of Dumbledore's mouth twitched. He continued,
"As ever, I would like to remind you all that the forest on the grounds is out of bounds to students, as is the village of Hogsmeade to all below third year. It is also my painful duty to inform you that the Interhouse Quidditch Cup will not take place this year."
"What?" Harry gasped. He looked around at Fred and George, his fellow members of the Quidditch team. They were mouthing soundlessly at Dumbledore, apparently too appalled to speak. Dumbledore went on,
"This is due to an event that will be starting in October and continuing throughout the school year, taking up much of the teachers' time and energy. But I'm sure you will all enjoy it immensely. I have great pleasure in announcing that this year at Hogwarts..."
But at that moment, there was a deafening rumble of thunder, and the doors of the great hall banged open. A man stood in the doorway, leaning upon a long staff, shrouded in a black travelling cloak. Every head in the great hall swiveled toward the stranger, suddenly brightly illuminated by a fork of lightning that flashed across the ceiling. He lowered his hood, shook out a long mane of grizzled, dark grey hair, then began to walk up toward the teacher's table. A dull clunk echoed through the hall on his every other step. He reached the end of the top table, turned right, and limped heavily toward Dumbledore. Another flash of lightning crossed the ceiling. Hermione gasped. The lightning had thrown the man's face into sharp relief, and it was a face unlike any Harry had ever seen. It looked as though it had been carved out of weathered wood by someone who had only the vaguest idea of what human faces are supposed to look like, and was none too skilled with a chisel. Every inch of skin seemed to be scarred. The mouth looked like a diagonal gash, and a large chunk of the nose was missing. But it was the man's eyes that made him frightening. One of them was small, dark, and beady. The other was large, round as a coin, and a vivid electric blue. The blue eye was moving ceaselessly, without blinking, and was rolling up, down, and from side to side, quite independently of the normal eye, and then it rolled right over, pointing into the back of the man's head, so that all they could see was whiteness. The stranger reached Dumbledore. He stretched out a hand that was as badly scarred as his face, and Dumbledore shook it, muttering words Harry couldn't hear. He seemed to be making some inquiry of the stranger, who shook his head unsmilingly and replied in an undertone. Dumbledore nodded and gestured the man to the empty seat on his right-hand side. The stranger sat down, shook his mane of dark grey hair out of his face, pulled a plate of sausages toward him, raised it to what was left of his nose, and sniffed it. He then took a small knife out of his pocket, speared a sausage on the end of it, and began to eat. His normal eye was fixed upon the sausages, but the blue eye was still darting restlessly around in its socket, taking in the hall and the students.
"May I introduce our new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher," said Dumbledore brightly into the silence, "Professor Moody."
It was usual for new staff members to be greeted with applause, but none of the staff or students clapped except Dumbledore and Hagrid, who both put their hands together and applauded. But the sound echoed dismally into the silence, and they stopped fairly quickly. Everyone else seemed too transfixed by Moody's bizarre appearance to do more than stare at him.
"Moody?" Harry muttered to Ron. "Mad-Eye Moody? The one your dad went to help this morning?"
"Must be," said Ron in a low, awed voice.
"What happened to him?"
Hermione whispered.
"What happened to his face?"
"Dunno,"
Ron whispered back, watching Moody with fascination. Moody seemed totally indifferent to his less-than-warm welcome. Ignoring the jug of pumpkin juice in front of him, he reached again into his travelling cloak, pulled out a hip flask, and took a long draught from it. As he lifted his arm to drink, his cloak was pulled a few inches from the ground, and Harry saw, below the table, several inches of carved wooden leg, ending in a clawed foot. Dumbledore cleared his throat.
"As I was saying,"
he said, smiling at the sea of students before him, all of whom were still gazing transfixed at Mad-Eye Moody.
"We are to have the honour of hosting a very exciting event over the coming months, an event that has not been held for over a century. It is my very great pleasure.